Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Professor Randall Coyne, who teaches criminal law, criminal procedure, capital punishment, constitutional law, and legal aspects of terrorism at the University of Oklahoma College of Law. He's the co-author of Capital Punishment and the Judicial Process, the first casebook devoted exclusively to the death penalty, and is a contributing author of the American Bar Association's publication, Death Without Justice, a Guide for Examining the Administration of the Death Penalty in the United States. Randall Coyne has represented condemned prisoners in California, Oklahoma, and Texas, and he served as trial counsel to the defense team in United States versus Timothy James McVeigh. He has an article at the UK Guardian, It's Time for the US Supreme Court to Declare a Death Penalty Moratorium. Welcome to Background Briefing, Randall Coyne.
Thank you, Ian. Pleasure to be with you today.
And your article in the UK Guardian suggests, it's a sort of plea to the Supreme Court to stop tinkering with the machinery of death. Do you think it's going to fall on deaf ears?
I'm not optimistic that the Supreme Court in the near future would impose a moratorium on executions. The political composition of the court at present makes that extremely unlikely, though I think it would be a wise move.
So do you think that, though, there is a kind of gathering storm taking place as a result of this botched execution in Oklahoma, where there's talk that perhaps there will be a critical mass in this country opposing capital punishment? The polls have indicated that there is, you know, from a minority to a growing majority, public opinion is changing.
Well, public opinion, I expect, will continue to change. The question becomes whether or not this horrific botched execution, which really embarrasses the state of Oklahoma in front of the entire world, will be the actual catalyst that serves as a tipping point in favor of a moratorium ultimately being put into place.
Well, both the governor of Oklahoma and Senator Imhoff, who represents Oklahoma in the U.S. Senate, basically have not apologized for the botched execution and essentially have said that this defendant, who apparently raped and then shot a 19-year-old woman and then his accomplices buried her alive, that's what they seem to be focusing on, that the defendant was so egregious that he deserved what he got. And that's not exactly an original refrain, is it?
No. And, of course, the crime committed by Mr. Lockett was horrific, and you do need to obviously keep the victims in mind. But the question is, should society stoop to that level? If a victim happens to be tortured to death, for example, does that give us as a humane society the right to inflict torture on that particular defendant? Or are we somehow better than the worst among us? And should we not lower ourselves to their level? Of course, there are many, particularly in the state of Oklahoma, who would say, absolutely, kill them and make it as painful as possible. Rather barbaric, but there you have it.
So is there, though, it appears to me to be a sort of inherent oxymoron, the idea of humane capital punishment. Is there such a thing?
Well, humane from what? From the standpoint of the spectators, right? When first presented in 1977 by the state of Oklahoma with the notion of a lethal injection, it seemed to be a rather comfortable way to attend an execution. You know, you wouldn't smell frying flesh. You wouldn't see a person's distended neck and twitching legs. You wouldn't watch blood spurt from a firing squad execution. Certainly it had the appeal of being easygoing on the spectators. From the standpoint of the person who's been locked into a bathroom-sized room for years and has been told for years, perhaps more than a decade, that the state is going to kill them one day, to be then strapped down and ultimately poisoned to death has to be a particularly horrific way of meeting one's maker. And whether or not the person who's being executed suffers has been left in doubt, of course, because one of the agents typically administered is a paralytic. So even if you were in agonizing pain as a person being lethally injected, you would be unable to exhibit the slightest discomfort to let people know that the execution wasn't working as intended.
Again, I'm speaking with Professor Randall Coyne, who teaches criminal law, criminal procedure, capital punishment, constitutional law, and legal aspects of terrorism at the University of Oklahoma College of Law. He's the co-author of Capital Punishment and the Judicial Process, the first casebook devoted exclusively to the death penalty, and is a contributing author of the American Bar Association's publication, Death Without Justice, a guide for examining the administration of the death penalty in the United States. Randall Coyne has represented condemned prisoners in California, Oklahoma, and Texas, and he served as trial counsel to the defense team in United States versus Timothy James McVeigh. He has an article at the UK Guardian, It's Time for the U.S. Supreme Court to Declare a Death Penalty Moratorium. So it's my understanding, Randall Coyne, that the this lethal cocktail in which is this now, I guess, the exemplar, if you will, of humane capital punishment was developed in Oklahoma, was it not? But the problem has been that European manufacturers of these drugs, there's three drugs involved, have curtailed the shipments to the United States. And it feels like the states in the United States who are executing prisoners are, in fact, just experimenting. They're, this is like, you know, it's like a high school chemistry experiment.
Well, it is, and it's a experiment involving live human beings, many of which apparently in increasing numbers seem to be suffering horrific, if not torturous, deaths at the hands of state officials. It brings to mind the experiments in Nazi Germany. Now, obviously, these people are in a different position than the innocent victims who were tortured and medically experimented on in Nazi Germany. These are folks that have supposedly had due process and been convicted after full and fair trials of horrific crimes. And yet again, the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution prohibits us from inflicting unnecessarily pain upon individuals, even the individuals that that same constitution gives us the right to kill.
So in terms of cruel and unusual punishment, what is the threshold? How do you get the attention of the Supreme Court justices to recognize that we've crossed that line?
Well, by examples such as that said in the Lockett execution yesterday. And Lockett is not, he's far from the first and certainly won't be the last as these experiments continue. As the drugs become more and more scarce, states will become more and more desperate to use alternative drugs from shady suppliers, perhaps. And it's likely that we'll see additional suffering, additional pain, additional constitutional violations taking place in death chambers throughout the United States.
So in your article, Randall Coyne, at the UK Guardian, it's time for this U.S. Supreme Court to declare a death penalty moratorium. You point out that African Americans comprise roughly 13% of the American population but account for 42% of the death row population. And since 1973, and around 140 prisoners have been released from death row with evidence of their innocence. I spoke yesterday with Sam Gross at the University of Michigan, who has done work on, in fact, there's a new report the American Academy of Sciences has just released on the number of people that are likely innocent on death row, above and beyond those that have been exonerated. And one of the things that was quite disturbing that came out of that interview was that even when a death row prisoner is found at least not necessarily so much found innocent, but there's enough ambiguity to remove the death penalty, that person rots away for the rest of their life in jail. And the momentum to prove them innocent just evaporates. And that seems like an ironic and cruel fact.
Well, it really is. And that, of course, has to do with the advent of life without the possibility of parole. In this business, in the death penalty defense industry at least, it's certainly considered a victory to either prevent a death sentence from being imposed or to remove a client from death row. That doesn't mean that folks who were once awaiting execution, who may well, in fact, be innocent, won't spend the rest of their lives in prison. But there just aren't enough resources, generally speaking, to fight the battles on behalf of those whose at least will be permitted to live. There have been some examples of folks removed from death row who were later demonstrated to be innocent and released from prison entirely. And, of course, those are the absolute grand slam victories in capital defense work.
So, Randall Coyne, given the unlikely nature of the Supreme Court conservative majority changing their mind soon, even in the face of this grim evidence from this botched execution in Oklahoma, you point out in your article in the UK Guardian that the states of Washington and Oregon have imposed moratoriums on executions, and five other states, Kansas, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and New Mexico, have either performed no executions or have only executed volunteers. So is this the way to go, or is this the way that it may happen?
Well, if enough states and enough governors follow suit and executions slow down to a trickle, then the odds are greatly increased that the Supreme Court will come to believe that the death penalty over time has grown unconstitutional, that it's no longer a punishment which society chooses to embrace.
Well, didn't the Supreme Court effectively come to that conclusion back in the 1970s? I remember Justice Stevens pointing this out, and then it sort of made a comeback in a way that I've never quite understood.
Yes, the death penalty was struck down by the Supreme Court in 1972 because a group of justices, the majority, decided that the death penalty was violating the 8th and 14th Amendments, that being sentenced to death was like being struck by lightning. There were no predictable ways of determining between two essentially comparable defendants who might receive the death penalty and who wouldn't, except for the, of course, unconstitutional basis of race. And again, the problem is that the corrections which were instated after the moratorium really haven't addressed the problem. We're still back in the 70s in a situation where the death penalty remains racist. What people need to understand is that the death penalty, though, and these governors I think well understand, is a luxury. In the millions of dollars we spend seeking to kill someone, as opposed to the other ways of spending the money, is just it's money that's not well spent. Hire more police officers, get better desks for the police officers, get better roads. Your tax money is supporting the death penalty, and it's far cheaper. All studies have shown it's far cheaper to put someone in prison for the rest of their life in a single cell and have them die in prison than it is to litigate to seek their execution, perhaps 20 years before they'll naturally die anyway.
So in terms of what the governor of Oklahoma has said in response to the national and international outrage over this botched execution, and your Senator James Imhoff as well, who's echoed her same sentiments, basically saying that this fellow deserved to die because he was such a heinous criminal, I'm sure you've borne the brunt of that kind of accusations. I mean, surely representing Timothy McVeigh, who must have been the least popular person in the state of Oklahoma after the bombing of the federal building, how do you confront that argument, which, of course, is pretty reflexive and the one that essentially needs to be confronted?
Well, I understand the argument because before I got involved in death penalty work, I was, like so many Americans, a supporter of the death penalty. They say the support for the death penalty is a mile long but only an inch deep. I didn't know about the death penalty. When I got involved in a death penalty case, I came to learn about the very many problems, and I formed what I consider an educated opinion about it now that doesn't permit me to support the death penalty for any number of reasons. And even to those people who might agree that Mr. Lockett, for example, deserve to be put to death, that doesn't mean that the state of Oklahoma deserved to torture him to death.
So then how do you overcome? Well, I mean, it seems to me that what we're dealing with here is the gulf between reason and rationality and emotion. In other words, the proponents of death penalty have the emotional argument, and those who oppose to it have the reasonable argument. And quite often in our culture, it seems that reason and rationality, in fact, I think, are increasingly becoming irrelevant.
Yeah, I think that's a valid observation. It makes the task of those who oppose the death penalty all the more difficult. But one of our chief weapons, I think, is the weapon of education. And I think as people come to understand more about the death penalty, how it's not imposed and inflicted only on the worst of the worst. How, for example, if you and I were to go in and rob a bank and I were to shoot the teller, I could agree to testify against you, and you might end up with a death sentence, and I, the actual killer, might end up with a lesser sentence, a sentence of, let's say, 30 years. It's not fairly imposed. It does discriminate. It's extremely expensive. And there are some people, I think, who believe that the death penalty, for religious reasons they have this belief, is too easy a solution, that the prisoner should be made to rot in prison for the rest of their life. That, for example, if Timothy McVeigh, who reportedly made a Catholic confession shortly before his execution, once he was executed, according to certain religious traditions, he would have been received into the kingdom of God. Well, he hadn't spent enough time paying the penalty for the 168 murders he was convicted of perpetrating.
So how do you deal with this religious justification versus the, I mean, to my mind, at least the Catholic faith is consistent in its opposition to death, whether it's the death penalty or their opposition to abortion. It seems that on the more evangelical and Protestant side of things, particularly as you get towards the more fundamentalist Christians, which I believe are quite powerful in your state of Oklahoma and dominate the legislature, how do you make that case that this is morally inconsistent?
Well, I think oftentimes you're unable to make case. Oftentimes you speak your piece and you just have to agree to disagree with those opponents, particularly if their views are grounded in their religious faith. You're not going to change their mind, but that doesn't mean you stop fighting.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Randall Coyne.
Yes, Ian, my pleasure. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. Again, I've been speaking with Professor Randall Coyne, who teaches criminal law, criminal procedure, capital punishment, constitutional law, and legal aspects of terrorism at the University of Oklahoma College of Law. He's the co-author of Capital Punishment and the Judicial Process, the first casebook devoted exclusively to the death penalty, and is a contributing author of the American Bar Association's publication Death Without Justice, a guide for examining the administration of the death penalty in the United States. Randall Coyne has represented condemned prisoners in California, Oklahoma, and Texas, and served as trial counsel to the defense team in United States versus Timothy James McVeigh. He has an article at the UK Guardian, "It's time for the US Supreme Court to declare a death penalty moratorium." We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about whether on this May Day working Americans will have a greater voice in their government that's largely responsive to the 1% in our money-driven political system.